Hi, this is Michael Ben. You can see me on the Netflix docuseries Losers. And thank you for listening to Verbal Shenanigans.
But our shenanigans are cheeky and fun.
Yeah, I mean, his shenanigans are cruel and tragic.
Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
Oh, hey, hello everybody. Welcome back to Verbal Shenanigans, the best podcast in town.
Scott, I checked things out. All the podcasts can be played in this town.
Okay.
I checked the ratings. We're not top.
All right, let me try again. Hey guys, welcome back to Verbal Shenanigans, sex for your ear holes.
Scott, I bought one of the t-shirts saying that, and we got some weird looks going out there in public. We may not want to go with that catchphrase just yet.
All right. I got one more. All right. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Verbal Shenanigans, spreading like a virus.
I got word from China. They didn't really appreciate that catchphrase.
Verbal Shenanigans. Coronavirus got nothing on us. No good? No. Well,
coronavirus with a side of Lyme disease.
We'll stick with our normal intro, which is usually me trying to figure out how to get to like the talking part that I enjoy, because the intro is always my least favorite part, guys. So I give you permission every episode to hit that little fast forward 15 seconds button on the podcast app to get to where we're actually talking about something of substance. So that is Mike. I am Scott. This is Verbal Shenanigans, episode 275. Crawling ahead here. 5-6 years in the making, whatever we're at. But welcome to the show. If you're just tuning in, it is a weekly podcast, and our goal is really essentially just to be somewhat entertaining until we get to the guest portion of the show and we kind of let them take over. and we do like to talk about life. We bring on interesting guests. We've had, I don't know, Berlo, at this point, I feel like we've checked the boxes of a lot. Like a couple of years, when we really started deciding to focus, be more guest-centric instead of like just the two of us all the time. Many years back now, we got a hippo attack survivor on the show after talking about a bit I had that I was working on. That bit never came to fruition too much either, but I tried it the other night randomly. But we reached out to this guy. We called him in the car, Paul Templer. He eventually came on. Long story short, we were like, it really inspired. That was the moment where like we could really try to get guests. And we went through this spreadsheet phase, I guess, if you will, where we were just throwing out ideas and what can we get, who can we get, what type of person can we get. We'd throw out like big names, and then we'd throw out like types of people. And years later, we got some of those names, like Lenny Dykstra. I think of, he was on the list. We got him.
A Jai Naidu from Office Space.
Yes. Yeah. So, but then we got everything from pogo stick champions to stool banks to people who made their own island to I don't know, you name it,
we got collector.
Oh yes. So we've really done it. So, but back then but we have checked, I would say, nearly every box that we've kind of category wise. I can't think of too many things that we haven't really got to. But yeah, we keep finding interesting people to talk to, which is cool because there's endless amounts of people that kind of inspire us.
If I recall, for some reason on the list was find a burn victim, which I still can't figure out how that came to be.
I literally just almost spit out a beer. find a burn victim.
If you got injured in a fire out there and you want to be on our show, call us up.
Well, maybe that was like late in the night after a couple beers and we were talking. Maybe that was like a throwaway and it made the list.
I mean, I gotta be honest, that sounds like a me idea. I can't deny it. Like as I've read it, it's like, yeah, I could see that coming from my mouth for some reason, but we got other guests from that spreadsheet, so we did do our due diligence on
the
thing.
We did. And tonight is no different, but we'll get to our guest in a few minutes. But so I guess this can kind of lead into a little game here. So we'll start kind of in the game territory today. So a guy I know every year, Chris Russo, Mad Dog Russo, from Mike and the Mad Dog. Every year he gives out Super Bowl tickets. And he runs this contest where you got to answer four questions. Okay. And a guy I know, he gets so into it, a guy that I work with and whatnot. And all these questions they ask throughout the week and they repeat a lot of the questions and they're really hard. Like you have to go, like it'll start with an easy question and then build its way up. And then the last one's an audio clip of someone talking and you have to say who it is. It's really, really hard. Mm-hmm. But it kind of becomes fun. Like you have to figure these things out. And usually there's a theme to the last questions. You got to figure out how they're connected. So in past years, it's been a lot of times linked to where the Super Bowl is. A lot of the questions are linked to who's playing in the Super Bowl. So a lot of questions were 49ers-centric and Chiefs-centric and Miami Dolphins-centric because that's where the Super Bowl is. Uh-huh. So this guy gets spreadsheets out and like he has them categorized and has the answers ready to go and research. And I always like get involved and help him. Like I'm like, John, give me a question and I'll like go and do because it's not like something you could especially when you get to the third or fourth question, it's not something you could pull up in Google in time. Like one of the questions would be like, who was the first Super Bowl MVP who only played one game during the regular season? Like it's crazy questions where you got to go back and look. So it does kind of become fun. I can see you enjoying it too. Like it's like a, you know, you got to look for things and kind of figure it out. And so the week goes on and we're the audio clips are insane. Like they could be anybody. And Chris Russo finally starts giving some hints and he throws out this, he throws out this writer's name, like a sports writer. So I go and I'm listening to the audio clip and I find the sports writer and I click on his one article he wrote about football and I go to the middle of his article and it's about the Chiefs announcer from Super Bowl I is still alive. Oh. Okay, his name is Tom Hendrick. And the other answers turned out to the two answers that had been answered already were other Toms. So we thought it was like all Toms from the Super Bowl. So he would get home from work and have his two sons' phones and his calling and calling and calling. And the three other audio clips were figured out, which we got two out of the three. We had them if we were going to get that far. Oh. And so Friday we're there and I'm on the elliptical. And I got my headphones on, I'm listening to it, and sure enough, a guy gets on, answers the question, it turns out to be that Tom Hendrick guy. I'm like, damn. So I call my friend John, and he was in the queue on hold. He would have been like next, right, before the guy. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And he spent all week, and he's like, yeah, the guy was like, yeah, it's like you and like three other people in the queue. So he would have been like next, and we had the answer to the question, but it was it was fun. The point is, it's like a fun, I don't know. You could get real deep into it, trying to figure out the theme, and you hear like little things, like the one thing the guy was saying, like, oh, well, even Joe was young back then, and we thought we could be a team to win, and everybody thought they were talking about Montana or Theismann or Joe Gibbs, Namath, and it turned out to be he had to give out a hint that it wasn't a quarterback, so. We went on the top 100 play, and it was Joe Green, Mean Joe Green. Oh. And it turned out to be one of his teammates from a college football. It's insane. So, but anyway, it was fun. So it kind of inspired me, Mike, to see if you could answer some of these questions about our podcast. So, starting off easy, because, you know, we talk to so many people that, you know, it kind of gets lost in the shuffle over the years. It kind of, you know, sometimes I have to go back and be like, who was that? And, yeah. And then, like, it's funny, I was telling you the other day, I was going through episodes, former episodes, and I don't know what I was thinking or we were thinking. I'll put some blame on you, too, just so I don't feel that bad. But we had these episodes. This was also back when we had no schedule. We'd rack up as many interviews as possible, do as much audio as possible, and kind of figure it out. I remember we would talk for hours, and I would cut things and take things and save them for weeks later. Like, I can't do it anymore. But there was episodes with four guests on. There was an episode with Christian Okoye from, you know, legendary football player.
Kansas City Chiefs.
We had the Jamaican bobsledder, Devin Harris. So another fascinating guy who we had on a second time. And we had Randy Santel, who has this huge following. He's a competitive eater. All three of those guys warrant their own episodes with their own audience. But we would cram things in. The other day, I found one that had like three people on it again. I'm like, every single one of these guys is interesting. So things were done a little differently back then. And episodes were like 2 hours, 2 hours and 20 minutes. It was bizarre. It's bizarre. Like, we'd get these good guests and they'd be like 75 minutes into the show. They would come on. So we've straightened it out. It only took us 5 years.
Yeah, if I recall from that episode you just mentioned, that was literally, we went into the day saying, damn it, we have no guests. And somehow we got all three of them on the same day. And I think it was just literally, you're like, I don't feel like doing editing. And you threw it all together in one episode.
That's probably accurate. And I bet you we probably had like other things lined up. And I don't know.
Yeah.
All right, Berlo. So we're going to call this Know Your Shenanigans. Know your shenanigans. We'll start easy and see how far you can get. Okay, and then if you get them wrong real early, we'll just start over and see. So a lot of them are just who these people are. Just jot in your memory and see if you remember who some of these people are. All right. So, Berlo, let's start with an easy one. Okay, the fans sent me this one. Berlo, who was Mike Stern? Who was Mike Stern?
Mike Stern. Ugh. This is the easy one?
That's great because your voice sounds exactly like Chris Russo's contest. I'd be like, oh, man, Super Bowl IV. And meanwhile, you could hear them like Googling things on their keyboards. As fast. Mike Stern, Berlo, do you have any idea?
He is the Pixar animation.
That is correct, Mike. That is correct. You are on your way to the...
Did I win the Super Bowl ticket, Scott?
You're on your way, Mike. We're right out of the game. The best is Chris Russo like makes fun of everyone so bad. He's like, you're terrible. You don't listen. He's like, none of you idiots are going anywhere. You got to do your homework. It's pretty entertaining, not going to lie. And you kind of get deep into it. All right, Mike. Entering to round two. Okay. Who was... David George Gordon. David George Gordon.
He was the Bug Chef.
That is correct, Mike. That is correct. You're on your way, Mike. You're on your way to the Super Bowl. Yeah. Oh, Mike. All right. Coming out of the gate. All right.
Next question. What was the 13th word said in Super Bowl 7?
Dude, that's how crazy. It's like, what color was the Gatorade in Super Bowl 13? Like, it's nuts. It's pretty fun. All right, Mike. So we'll do different sets of four questions. So you're caller one right now, right? So,
all right.
And this is usually where the music kicks in. All right, Mike. Question three's we gotta step it up a little harder. Okay. Who was Wayne Adams? Wayne Adams. This is where usually the Super Bowl music's playing. No cheating, Mike. No cheating. That's what Chris Russo says a lot. Dun, 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 dun. Five.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. All right.
Four.
My answer,
Mike,
is...
I need an answer, Mike. Mike in Jersey, I need an answer.
Canada Island.
That is correct, Mike! Oh, everybody! Mike did his homework. Mike did his homework. If you guys are wondering what the hell, just go listen to Chris Russo when he does. Mikey did his homework. Mike, if you go to the Super Bowl, who you taking, Mike?
Probably my wife, because she's probably listening right now, Scott.
All right, Mikey's going to take his wife to the Super Bowl. Let's see, Mike. I don't think you're going to get there, but who knows? There we go. Let's play the audio clip. I don't have any audio clips loaded, so. All right, Mike. We'll start. We'll make this not the hardest of some of the questions. Mike, one of our episodes was entitled Bob and Ben. Bob and Ben. Who were Bob and Ben?
Bob was Bob Rathbone.
That is correct. Bob Rathbone, Atlanta Hawks announcer, Mike. You're one step away from going to the Super Bowl, Mike. Don't look it up, Mike.
Like, I know.
Don't worry. You get a second shot at this. Bum, 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 bum. Mike, I need an answer out there in Georgia.
I'm going to say, I'm going to guess it, Red Bull Kayaker.
Mike, it was, I need a name, Mike. I need a name. Ben.
I need a name.
Chris, you
Ben
think we're giving, you think we're giving Super Bowl tickets away for free, Mike? Dun, 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 dun. I'm sorry you said Ben Roethlisberger, but... You were close, Mike. So close. It was Ben Brown. Ben Brown, the Red Bull kayaker, was correct. But
oh, I was right with the kayaker.
I can't send you to the Super Bowl, Mike. I'm sorry. Yeah. Let's get someone else on the line. Let's get these tickets away, Mike. All right. Next caller. Caller, are you there?
Yeah, I'm the same guy. I had two phones, Mikey, so...
Oh, all right. You're back for more, aren't you? Well, that's what's interesting, too. He'll have, like... Some guys will get on, like, 3 days in a row. So, like, he'll be like, oh, Mike, you're back for more, huh? It's pretty great. All right. All right, Mike, we'll start you with an easy one here.
All right.
Mike, who was Darren Hudson? Darren Hudson.
Darren Hudson, Mike.
Oof. Mike, you gotta do your homework. Mike, I think no Googling, Mike. No Googling.
I'm not Googling.
Yes,
I'm
you are. Googling. I see your eyes, Mike. Mike, five. Four. Three. Two. Mike, final guess.
Jamaican bobsledder.
No, I'm sorry. That was the professional lumberjack, Mike. That was
Hansen. That was a good one.
Way back to the early days. All right, let's get another caller in line. We got to give these tickets away. Caller?
Yeah, I had a landline as well.
God damn it. Mike, you're back for more. All right.
Yeah, I'm up for punishment. What can I tell you?
All right, Mike, round one. No Googling. Here we go. Who was Tony Borglum? Tony Borglum.
Oh, Tanks.
Tanks is correct.
Yep.
Why don't you explain what they did, Mike?
Well, they were an organization that let you rent a tank and all. You literally give them a few hundred dollars and you can like run over cars. You can shoot the cannon.
Yes. I believe
it was literally called Rent a Tank.
I believe he might have been on the episode with the sleep the sleep guy who didn't sleep.
No. The sleep guy was with the Canadian Island people.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right.
But he did have share the episode with somebody because, again, we couldn't possibly separate the two.
No. All right, Mike. You're rolling. You're on to question two. All right, Mike. Let me get me a good one here. All right, Mike. In episode 41, we had an interview with my mistress. Who was my mistress?
That would be Sharon Alexander, Scott.
Oh, Mike. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. My mistress was Brian Einarsson. Brian Einarsson.
Oh yeah, it was the two-parter too.
Yeah, Mike, I'm sorry.
We couldn't separate interviews, but we decided that one got too special.
Ah, yes, Brian. I'm sorry. Yes, Sharon Alexander would have made sense, but she was a little later in the
year
or in our growth. All right, I'm sorry, Mike. You're not going to win today. We got to give these tickets away, people. Caller, you're on the line.
Yeah, I gave a fake name. It's Mike again.
Damn it! All right, Mike, you're back for more. Let's start easy here with round one.
Yeah, everybody realized you don't really have tickets, Scott. I gotta be honest,
Mike.
That's why I'm getting through so fine.
Who was Keith Allen? Keith Allen.
He was the actor in Z Nation.
So. That is correct, Michael. You're through the gate. You're starting. You're getting hot. All right, Mike. Here we go. What was the first episode you appeared on? What number episode was the first episode you appeared on?
Episode 24, Comedians Are Dumb.
Let's fact check that. I think
because you were gonna say 25, the Redskins one.
Yeah, Mike. I'm sorry. 25. You were on Privacy is Dead, episode 25. You and Doug Max. Comedians are Dumb was episode 29. You were actually, Mike.
Oh.
You were on 25. Yep, you were on 26, 27, The Ghost Cast, 28, Santel versus Sabretti, and then 29, Comedians Are Dumb. So we've been assuming that you've been on even longer than you thought.
Oh, look at me. I'm
Mike, your debut. Hungry.
Yeah.
Your debut was let's see. October 5th, 2014. Was your debut. Wow.
Comedians Are Dumb were 29. Yep.
Wow. Well, Mike, I'm sorry. You're just not going to win the ticket. I can't give them away.
Well, I'm going to keep calling in. I mean, you really have no other audience if you look at things.
Well, so. Let's assume you got that one right. Which I have two more questions
for
you.
Let's assume.
All right. Mike, who was Josh Holcomb?
That sounds like the name of the Cleveland Browns quarterback. But I know it's not that.
No, we didn't have him on. You would have known if we had him on. No, Kelly Holcomb, right?
That's right.
This is a hard one. This was a round three question. What I love is you're making the same sounds that all the people on the Super Bowl thing. Like they would just try to buy time. They're like, oh, that's a tough one, Chris.
I'm gonna throw out a guess. Sky Falconry.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mike. He was a member of the band Lucky Chops. We interviewed Lucky Chop, who was our first interview with the guys from Raby Entertainment, who have brought us many, many guests.
Shout out to them.
Mike, you're not going to win the Super Bowl tickets, but this is one of my level four questions. Okay, this one's tough.
Okay.
But it is gettable. Mike, who was Mike D'Amico? This is one that is a perfect example, Mike, that you could, like, if you got it on the radio, you couldn't Google it super quick.
Mm-mm. Is he your buddy who got your NES game?
No, but that was going to be my other level four question. Good guess. That was Mike Iwanicute. So this was my favorite, but Mike D'Amico.
Oh, I'm still trying to answer the question.
I'm out of questions. This is it.
Oh, was he Kilt Fest?
Mike, I'm sorry. You're just, you know who Mike D'Amico was? Mike D'Amico is the real name of Teddy Roosevelt.
Oh.
Yes,
Teddy. Yeah, I would never. You gave me 10 guesses. I wasn't going to get to that one.
Teddy Roosevelt was this guy that dressed up like Teddy Roosevelt and kind of gained a little bit of viral fame, if you will, from the World Cup. Remember getting him. So, Mike, you're not going to be going to the Super Bowl. You're not going to go to the Shenanigans Showdown, if you will. But next year, there's always another chance on Know Your Shenanigans. But
one of these days, I'll really remember one of our guests. It'll happen sometime.
Mike, who's Sid Udy?
Puppetry the penis. Final answer.
Mike, who is John Walsh? Callahan?
He was the one that ran around like a goat for a couple weeks. I had a stomach built for himself.
Thomas Thwaites. There's a couple I wouldn't know. I was going through some of the lists. Like Mike Berry was one that I was like, oh, yeah, he's like one of the underwater guys.
Underwater criminal investigation. Yeah. I would have got that one.
Well, too bad you didn't get the ones you were given. Listen, you don't make the contest, Mike. You participate.
All right. Well, let me throw you one.
Oh, all right.
Who is Anna Teresa?
Anna Teresa?
Yep.
Mother Teresa's daughter. Final answer.
Nope.
Anna Teresa. Hold on. Let me actually legitimately try to think about this. Anna Teresa.
Nope. No Googling.
I'm not. I'm actually looking at you.
Okay.
Anna Teresa. No idea. No idea. I'm going to go with, she wasn't the serial killer museum.
Nope.
Was she the one from the Your Call Football? No, that was Julie Behringer, I think. All right, who was she?
She was the manager of Justin Parker for the UPWA Live podcast.
Jesus Christ. We interviewed her?
Yep, she was one of the people we got there.
Mike, I hate to tell you, I try to block that podcast out of my mind. We real quick before we get to it, I guess, me and Mike did a podcast. Mike, look it up. What number was that?
That was 80.
80, so a long time ago. We went to a wrestling event. And that was going to be one of our questions. Who was the only guest we ever called? Like, who was the first guest we called live, like, on a podcast where we just called out somebody and tried to get them on? Pete Nixon would have been the answer. So our friend Pete Nixon, he's a wrestler. We got to go call the event and interview a bunch of people. Highlight of the event, interviewing Earl Hebner, which was pretty damn cool. But the event was like 4 hours long. We were trying to get to a Connor fight like hours and hours before that. We were there till like 10 o'clock and the guy kept telling us like, yeah, I'll do the interview. He was the owner of the organization. And we were like, okay, all right, okay. And we were just there for hours and hours. And we tried to call. Guys, two people trying to call a wrestling match through audio, not very exciting.
No.
Especially the match we called.
Yeah, that was like I tried to prepare, like listening to classic commentaries. There was not a lot of classic moves in that matchup, my friend.
No.
And then kind of figure out how long we were there for. Like when we were waiting for the owner to come by so we can do the interview, I think the pay-per-view just started. By the time we finally recorded it, packed up, and left, I think we literally got to the bar 2 minutes before the Connor fight.
Yeah, wasn't that was that Connor Aldo? Was that the fight? The 6 second one?
I don't think it was that one.
I don't remember who it was.
I think it was like a first round knockout, but it wasn't the quick one.
Yeah. All right, Mike. You got another one before we get to our guest? You got someone for me?
Sure. How about Tom Zuber?
Tom Zuber was the owner of Demented Brewing.
That is correct, Scott.
Who is no longer business is out of business, guys. Yes, a former sponsor of this podcast. Out of business. Sorry, guys. It was probably our fault.
Yeah. Anybody who supports us dies in the end.
You got one more?
Sure. I just had it a minute ago. Okay, who is Paul Schizler?
What is it again? Paul who?
Schizler. S-C-H-I-S-S-L-E-R. Oh,
Paul Schizler. He was part of the guys who created Comedy Wire.
That is correct.
Nice, yeah. Which, that site's a little weird. I tried to get on the other day and, like, I don't know, it wasn't really working. I wanted to see how it was still going. I don't know how well it's still going, but Comedy Wire was a pretty cool website. Paul Schizler, he's actually a pretty funny comic. But again, if we had him on the podcast, they're probably closed down and no longer.
Probably, yeah. We've killed so many businesses, except our own somehow.
Well, when your business profits zero, it's hard to kill it. You know, like it's. But all right.
Let me give you one more.
One more. All right, give it to me.
Rick Woodbury.
Oh my God. Wait. He's coming to my brain. Is he the one? I'm between two. Was he the one who was making those cars?
Yep, commuter cars.
Yes!
Mini cars.
Yes, I was between that, or he was the guy from the Dig In. I can't remember. But you know what? One of these days we're gonna post a master list on our social media of all the guests we've ever had. We got to put that out there. But so we're gonna. It's time to add another guest to the show, and I'm excited for this one. It's certainly unique, that's for sure. I've been pumped about this guest for a couple weeks now since I had gotten in touch with him, and we've been trying to set something up. Now, a couple weeks ago, I was watching Netflix. It's this new thing, you know. You could stream things. It's really amazing. And I put
what channel is it on my cable?
And I put on this documentary series called Losers. And the first episode was really, really good. And it was about this boxer by the name of Michael Bent. Now, I also told you to watch it right afterwards, after I got in touch with Michael. And it's just really interesting. This guy was a heavyweight champion. But the interesting part of it was this guy, he never really enjoyed his time boxing. And he was able to rise to some of the highest recognitions in boxing and has done some amazing things in his career post-boxing. So I'm really excited to give Michael a call. I know you watched the documentary too, so...
Yeah, it was an incredible story, and we're definitely going to dive into everything that made him a champion and how he got out and what he's been dealing with since.
And we're also scheduling a Berlew versus Bent prize fight coming up in October, but we'll get more into that later. So Berlew's been training pretty heavy, I should say.
Yeah. So I just Googled boxing. So far, so good. We'll see where we go from there.
All right, so let's get Michael Bent on the line.
So where are you based at, man? You're in New York or where?
So we're in New York, Jersey, and then actually my co-host there, Mike, which you should hear, he's down in Georgia. So we're kind of spread out all over the place.
Georgia. What part of Georgia?
I'm living in Douglasville, about 30 minutes west of Atlanta.
You know what, man? I have family in Douglasville.
No way.
No kidding.
Yes.
Maybe you guys are related.
Well, me and Mike?
Yeah, the two Mikes, two Mike B's. You never know. Things get disjointed.
We have the same last name. We have the same first names, like, you know, the same almost last name. So we could be. You never know. You never know, man.
It's a tiny world. You never know.
So, Mike, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show. I
my pleasure.
I'll start right where kind of how this all set up. So I turned on Netflix the other day and I put on Losers, and right away the first episode is you, and it grabbed me in the first, 5 minutes of the show. I found it, you know, one, I always love stories with fighters and athletes and people who overcame things, and your story popped out really quickly because you're not the conventional heavyweight champion of the world who this was his whole life's purpose, wanted, did it, right. and then fell from grace. Right. You actually kind of got up, started down, got up, went down, and then moved to like a whole different area, I guess, in life. How did let's start there. How did the documentary come about, and how did you get involved in the making of that?
Okay, so I have a friend, this Canadian boxing journalist. His name was Bryn Butler, genius, journalist, blah, blah, blah. And I was connected to him by Thomas Hauser. You know Thomas Hauser?
No, not
familiar.
Not that I know.
Well, Tom Hauser is one of the preeminent, boxing journalists, man. Of the last 60 years, bro.
Right.
He did a autobiography on Muhammad Ali and countless other things as well. You know, he served as the executive producer for HBO Boxing at one point.
Gotcha.
And Tom is a dear friend. I actually met Tom maybe 4 or 5 months after I lost to Herbie Hyde. He gave me a call, said, Mike, let's have dinner. And Tom is the first person who made me introduce me to Muhammad Ali, because he was friends with Muhammad. So, so Tom made, yeah, I'm sorry?
No, I said that's amazing.
Yeah. So Tom hooks me up with this kid named Bryn Jonathan Butler. He's a writer from Canada. I think from not Toronto, but the outskirts. And we just clicked. So we maybe about 4 or 5 years after we meet, Bryn says to me, Michael, I'm working on this documentary piece for Netflix. Why don't you sit down with the director and producer and see if they would use you. I'm like, great, why not? So we connected with the director whose name was Mickey Dozy. And from there, we just we shot 2 days in LA and 2 days in Queens, New York, where I grew up. And, I'm not trying to pack those guys on the back, but they did a stellar job.
For sure.
They
did.
Yeah. They nailed the narrative completely, man. And the animation portion of it really resonates with a whole bunch of people. So I'm just happy that those guys found me and we found them, and that connection is forever in stockpiles or whatever.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
Now, when they approached you to do this story, I mean, how hard is it to just tell, considering this is not just your boxing career, it's how you were grown up and all the things that happened with your family. Was it just easy to chat about this, or is there times where you're just I may need a minute, or they have to convince you to kind of let loose?
Well, you know what? That's a great question, man. But to answer that, if I was just coming out of boxing, a year or two out of boxing, I would not have been able to be that honest. But the fact that, I'm a trained actor for, 25 years, that gives you permission to, say stuff that, society does not want you to say.
Right.
That mom and dad, does not want you to say. I was just ask me the questions, and I'm going to give you the complete, unvarnished truth. Some of it is ugly, some of it is beautiful, but most of it is fucked up.
Yeah, well,
pardon my French.
No. Let's get into that. This is not completely normal, because you got to the highest levels of in the boxing world, but yet, as you revealed through the documentary, you were not in love with it a whole lot of the time. But what was pushing you? If I'm not in love with doing comedy and I just go up there and half-ass it, very hard to succeed. Boxing, I can't imagine you're half-assing it, because you can't. You have to be better than your opponent. What is driving you during this time to still be good, even though you're not feeling this love connection to it?
I think the primary thing that drove me, two things. One was the loss of my first mentor, who was a cat named George Pimentel. And George Pimentel was a Dominican brother from, like, you know, from Queens. Right. And I would spar with George as a, like, you know, as a 9-year-old, and he would get my behind, like, unapologetically. And, you know, I quit boxing at the age of 9. That's when my father, like, you know, gave me a masterful, like, you know, whipping, blah, 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 right? That's his stuff, not mine, right? So, like, you know, cut to, like, you know, about 4 or 5 years later, I'm cutting school, and my brother had a paper route. So I grabbed the newspapers, I cut school, I go upstairs and, like, you know, flip to the front page, and it says, like, the headline, USA boxing team perishes in plane crash in Poland.
Yeah.
So I'm like, you know, flip to the paper, man, and my guy George is right there, and I started crying. And George Pimentel, like, you know, although he, like, you know, he would, like, you know, like, bust my behind, like, you know, he loved me. And he would, like, you know, like, encourage me in ways that my father didn't or couldn't. And so at that moment, like, you know, I made the decision to, like, you know, to dedicate my life as a boxer to Georgie. And also, like, you know, I knew that, like, you know, when I started traveling and, like, you know, making the USA boxing team, that was a way of getting out of my father's orbit. Because if, like, you know, if I wasn't traveling, like, you know, every couple of months overseas to USA boxing camp, blah, 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 something horrific is going to happen with me and my father. Either he's going to kill me or I'm going to kill him.
Jeez.
Period. No. That's real, man.
No,
that's real.
It's just amazing. It's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
You were incredibly decorated in your amateur career, made multiple gold gloves. I mean, tell us what kind of is the difference between when you become amateur and when you go pro? Because obviously you had that devastating first loss going to pro, and they keep on saying it's night and day. But in layman's terms, is it the speed? Is it the technique? What changed?
I think in layman's terms, man, like, you know, you have a guy like, say, take a guy like Ray Mercer, right? Who started boxing at 24, 25. Ray went off to beat me in the Olympic trial finals and capture an Olympic gold medal, right? And, like, you know, he went on to become a wonderful professional. I think it's all timing and whether or not, like, you know, the athlete, either he's, like, you know, overworn by the trauma of sparring and training, blah, 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 and fights, or just, like, you know, he peaks at the right time. And Ray peaked at the right time. I happened to peak when I fought Tommy Morrison. Yeah. You know, I made a vow to myself, like, you know, there is no way in the world, like, you know, that Tommy is beating me. Because, like, you know, when we were amateurs, you know, Tommy was, like, on the D team. I'm not disparaging Tommy, but, like, you know, it's a fact.
Right.
Tommy Morrison was a D team fighter. I was an A team guy. And, like, you know, and I knew that, like, you know, when I fought Tommy, Tommy had the choice of either fighting me or somebody else. But, like, Tommy pushed for me. Bill Caton, like, you know, Tommy's manager, like, you know, said to Tommy, no. You do not want to fight Michael Bennett.
Right.
And Tommy lobbied and pushed, like, to fight me. And, like, you know, he got to fight. I guess he has something to do. Because, like, you know, if I'm Tommy Morrison, and, like, you know, the hotshot guy suffered, like, you know, a knockout loss in his first pro fight, and I'm the champion now, guess what? I want to, like, you know, prove myself against that hotshot guy in the amateurs. Evander Holyfield once said that you make your reputation in the amateurs. And I think, like, you know, that was part of Tommy's thinking to, like, you know, get revenge or, like, you know, silence this guy who was this amateur hotshot.
Right.
Along with Lance Tyson to the boat.
Now, so it sounds like you're going through these things and you're fighting for almost not to let down other people. You don't want to make other people upset, and you're going through it. You're doing it for, you know, just what you said, whether it was fear of your father or not letting your coaches down. Whatnot. So when you actually end up beating Tommy Morrison and you get this WBO heavyweight belt, what are the feelings? Are you like, yes, at that point, are you like, I did it myself? Or are you happy that you are able to kind of keep the critics at bay, if you will? Like, are you where you're saying, okay, I did it for you guys. Look how good I am. What are your feelings after you win that belt, considering your mentality at this point?
That's a great question, man. Like, you know, boxing is one of the only, it's probably the only sport, like, you know, person who wins or loses should never, ever feel accountable to anybody. But, like, you know, you don't learn that in boxing. Because, like, you know, boxing has, like, you know, a really weird understanding of, like, you know, what to do and what to say. But, like, you know, when I got with, and also, like, you know, when you're in the midst of, like, the great trainers who I've been, like, in the midst of, like, Georgie Benton, Eddie Mustafa Muhammad,
yeah,
my amateur, Artie Cintron, like, you know, these people taught me how to think, like, you know, not like, you know, the quote-unquote, like, you know, normal boxer. They were like, you know, Mike, like, you know, hey, listen, you're smart, you're intuitive, you're curious, like, you know, if there are no dumb answers or no dumb questions.
Yeah.
So you can ask what you want and be who you are. So, like, you know, I never, like, you know, went into the Tommy Morrison fight, like, you know, thinking, like, you know, well, I have to do this to my father. No, my father was, like, you know, the furthest person I was thinking about, because he made me, he forced me to box, and I never wanted to box. And my father, I say this, like, you know, to no fault of his own, he was raised by his father to be, like, you know, a maniac.
Yeah.
And his father was raised by his father's, like, you know, father's father, blah, blah, blah. So, like, you know, I'm not, like, you know, I've learned, like, you know, not to blame my father, but, like, you know, he has to hold himself accountable. If I was to treat my son, I have a 14-year-old son, and if I was to treat my son the way that my father treated me, like, you know, I wouldn't want to live.
What do you think it was about? What was it about boxing that you think that's what your dad wanted you to do so bad? What? Why did he choose boxing, and what made him push you so hard into that?
Well, another good question, my man. You're filled with man. My father was, like, you know, a notorious street fighter. He was Jamaican, and he was a notorious street fighter on the streets of Kingston, Jamaica.
Okay.
He went from Jamaica to England, which, like, you know, colonized Jamaica at one point. And, like, you know, he was a notorious like street fighter, you know, in London. Word is my father had to leave the country, leave England, and come to the States because, like, you know, he got into a beef and, like, you know, beat some guy up who was connected with, like, you know, the boys over there.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, bounce over to the States. And once again, like, you know, my dad, like, you know, is, like, you know, he's the kind of guy who would, like, walk into a room, man, and he would change the molecules. He's, like, charismatic. He was good looking, blah, blah, blah. But they had these demons.
Right.
You know, so, but, like, you know, his thing was, like, you know, not to educate us, but to dominate us. And if he said, like, you know, Mike, like, you know, go outside and wash the car in, like, you know, 15 degrees below zero weather, you wash the goddamn car in 15 degrees, you know, below zero weather. You do that. If you say, Mike, like, you're going to be a boxer, you're going to be a boxer. And not to, like, you know, go on the story, but, like, the day I became a man, Scott was like, you know, I cut school in the fifth grade, man. I'll never forget this day, man. And, you know, I knew, like, you know, something was, like, you know, shaking me, like, was like, you know, really, like, you know, it was, like, uncomfortable. And I didn't like boxing. I loved Georgie Pimentel, but, like, you know, I didn't like boxing because I was getting hit. And who likes to get hit?
No. Yeah.
So I cut school, and I was on the way home. It was, like, maybe like 2:45, 3 o'clock, and my father typically got home about 4 o'clock. And I knew if I told him that I didn't want to box, I'd get my ass beat. I didn't imagine, like, you know, to the extent, though, of the ass beating. So I walked inside, man, and, like, you know, when he got home from work, you know, I walked in the kitchen and said, I'm like, you know, in the living room, I said, Dad, like, you know, I don't want to box anymore. And he went ballistic because, like, you know, my father, I've, like, you know, I've come to learn through my own, like, you know, self-analysis, blah, blah, blah. Rejection is the one thing that he is afraid of and that he will confront till his death. doesn't like rejection, be it rejection from a friend, be it rejection from a woman, be it rejection from society, blah, blah, blah. But like, you know, my father was like, you know, once again, he was very charismatic. That's like, you know, that's like a function of like, you know, emotional intelligence, man. He would work for Italians who were connected in the construction business, and they would hire him. Like, he would always, he's always the first guy that, like, you know, that they would hire. So he had that, like, you know, mechanism of, like, you know, of how to turn on and off. But at home, man.
Right.
Well.
Yeah.
So you get this title, and I'm kind of curious to know, are you emotionally happy now, even though you're in a sport that you're not like truly in love with, looking at this title, and kind of are you getting a lot of "see, I showed you" kind of stuff? Because like I think back to your story, how you even talked about after you got knocked down the first round, you're getting notes on your car saying, "Haha, first round you got knocked out." Is there any kind of like true like enjoyment or any kind of closure and anything that occurred?
Scott, to me, you know, maybe because like, you know, I'm hypersensitive, or maybe because like, you know, I embrace the fact that I'm hypersensitive. All fighters are super duper sensitive. Mike Tyson, Muhammad Ali, Joe Frazier, like, you know, Larry Holmes, super, super sensitive. Like, you know, they're not, well, some of them are not able to express that, you know, but I am, thankfully. I answer your question, man. Like, you know, it wasn't a fuck you to my father, but it was a fuck you to my father. You know what I mean? And it was like, you know, an F you to everybody else, like, you know, who doubted my, my will. You know, but like, you know, the best part that I enjoyed about boxing wasn't like, you know, wasn't the fighting and the winning. It was like, you know, being amongst that, like, you know, that group of guys who got each other. You know, I met Roy Jones when he was 17 years old. And when I first met Roy, he was like, when he saw me, he's like, you know, he was like starstruck. He's like, "Yeah, you're Michael Bam." I'm like, "Yeah, what's up, bro?"
Right.
It was like, you know, Florida, and like, you know, he's like, you know, like bowing down to me. I'm like, "Whoa, that's heavy," you know. But you know, the amateurs makes you have these friendships that you can't break them. I'm good friends with a guy named Darren Allen. Darren Allen was like, you know, a guy from a fighter from Columbus, Ohio. And Darren and I, he was like my best friend on the USA boxing team. He won the 1986 World Championships. He beat this fighter named Henry Mosky from Germany, who became a professional world champion. And like, you know, Darren and I, like, you know, we spoke the same language. A lot of boxers, like, you know, don't speak the same language because, like, you know, they bind to, like, you know, the tough guy stuff.
Right.
And boxing is about being tough. It's about being smart, in my estimation.
Now, so a big key piece to the documentary, and I guess to maybe onto the future of your career or a turning point in your career, was your post-knockout, I guess, article, you can call it, or a piece that you wrote about what it's like to kind of be knocked out and coming out of it. When were you inspired to do that on your own, or were you asked to do, like, were you asked, "Hey, what is it like?" Or did you just come up with that on your own? Because I went back and found it, and it's really fascinating, kind of what you wrote and how honest you were about it. So how did that come about?
Well, my ego, my friend. I was in, I was training a fighter named, Don Diego Puder. And he was, in the training camp of Virgilio Torre. Virgilio Torre was the first lightweight champion for the Netherlands. And I was over there, like, you know, working with this young kid, Don Diego Puder. And, like, you know, I didn't want to be there. This is, like, you know, not not too soon after my knockout loss to Herbie Hahn, I had retired, blah, blah, blah. Like, you know, Stan Hoff and my then manager said, Mike, like, you know, why don't you train boxers, man? Like, you know, you speak their language. So, like, you know, so I was training this kid, and I'm over in, like, you know, in the Netherlands, man. And a boxing journalist, his name was Fred Burkham. He's from the UK. He comes over and does a piece on me. And before he starts writing the piece, he says, Mike, like, you know, you don't look happy. I'm like, that's very perceptive, man. And he says, what do you want to do? And I say, what you're doing. What do you mean? I'm saying, like, write. I want to write. Because in my mind, like, you know, it's, I know rap, writing is a craft, just like boxing is a craft. You know, to write well, you have to be open to, like, you know, being unapologetically honest or unapologetically full of shit.
Right.
I'm unapologetically honest. And, like, you know, when I said that, I want to do what you do, it clicked with me. He just said, well, like, you know, well, start writing. And so I happened to be at a press conference with Bert Sugar. My friend Artie Curry, who works for HBO, he invited me to this press conference, which I did not want to be at in the least. You know, I didn't want to be around. You know, I didn't want to be around boxing. But I'm not about boxing. So I meet Bert Sugar, and Bert says, like, "Hey, Michael Bent, blah blah blah." I wrote a piece for the New York Daily News, like, maybe a year before that, about the comeback of Mark Breland as a professional under Emmanuel Stewart. And Bert had read the piece. He said, Mike, like, you know, I want you to write for my magazine. I said, great. So, like, you know, so we, like, he gave me a couple of assignments, you know, profile pieces on, like, boxers like Michael Grant, David Tua, blah, blah, blah. And then at one point he said to me, Michael, I have a piece that only you can write. Shit. I'm like, Bert, I'm like, what is it? He said, I want you to write a piece about getting knocked out and knocking somebody out and what that feels like emotionally, blah, 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 blah. Oh, boy. And I tap danced for, like, maybe 2 weeks, you know, before writing that piece, because I was afraid of it. You know, because in order to, like, you know, do that piece justice, I have to dig out in my closet, like, you know, the copy of my Herbie Hyde fight, of him, like, you know, like, completely demolishing me. And I didn't want to confront that. I didn't want to, like, you know, confront that yet. Or so I thought. Until one day, like, you know, I just, like, you know, say, you know what, man? No. One day I was at the Golden Gloves finals or quarterfinals in New York, and Bert Sugar was there. And he was, like, standing next to this old man. Have you heard the story before?
No.
Okay. So Bert is at the Golden Gloves, right? And I'm there. I was invited, blah, blah, blah. And Bert, like, you know, he's looking at me, but, like, you know, he doesn't want to say anything to him because, like, you know, I'm, like, you know, I'm well with deadline for this piece, right? And, like, you know, I guess he sensed my anxiety or, like, you know, discomfort with it. And there's a short, white-haired cat to his right? And this guy, he turns to me, and he says, "Michael, write the fucking piece." You know, that guy was Bud Schulberg, man. Jeez. Bud Schulberg, yeah, you know, right? That Bud Schulberg. And you know, I knew who Bud Schulberg a little before. Like, you know, I knew who he was, like, you know, before I started boxing. And you know, that lit a fire on me. I'm like, you know what? Shit. If this guy believes in me, okay. So I went back to my spot, man. I locked myself in the room for, like, 2 days, man, banged the piece out. And Anatomy of a Knockout was born. And about maybe, like, a year later, I got a phone call from Ron Shelton. Said, Michael, if you can write like you can, if you can act like you can write, come out to L.A., I'll get you an audition for this piece on Muhammad Ali that, like, you know, that they're talking about, blah, blah, blah. And cut to, like, you know, a year and a half later, I'm in L.A. and, you know.
So crazy.
Yeah, go figure, bro. Go figure.
You go from getting knocked out and writing this piece that you like you said, you're fearful of, to starring opposite of Will Smith as one of the all-time greatest boxers. You're playing the role of another all-time greatest boxer. It's got to be this amazing, like, how the hell did this happen moment when those cameras start rolling.
You have no idea how much, like, prior to going to L.A., you have no idea. I'm not, I used to be a Muslim. I guess technically I still am a Muslim, but, like, you know, I used to be, like, you know, heavily, like, you know, into, like, you know, religion, like, you know, Christianity, Islam, blah, blah, blah. Like, but then I stepped away from it, right? And let me tell you something. Like, you know, I never prayed so much, like, before getting that Get On Ali, I never prayed that much. And I was, like, down on my knees, like, you know, five times a day, like, praying, please give me this. I'm working with Michael Mann. I knew who Michael Mann was when I was, like, 15 years old with Heat, you know. I'm working with, like, you know, Jeffrey Wright. I'm working with, like, you know, Will Smith, Jamie Foxx. If there's a God, I don't know if there's one, but, like, you know, my man, if there's a God, please give me this. I'll do whatever you want. Of course, I lied, but, like, you know. You know. So I got the gig, man, like, you know, and L.A. was like a life-altering experience, man. It was, like, transformative. People I met, you know, the conversations I had with people, like, you know, who were in the industry, like, you know, and, you know, the reason why, like, you know, acting and actors and, like, people who were, like, artists, like, you know, hit me so hard because, like, you know, I mean, they embrace how damaged they are, you know, they embrace their scar tissue, man, and, like, you know, the average person, like, you know, the average citizen, like, you know, mom, dad, they're full of shit. I include myself in that as well. I'm full of shit from time to time. I have to catch myself. Oh, man, like, you know, come on.
Now, when you go to from writing to acting, is there any kind of resentment to getting into it in the sense that when you write and you get some emotions out, you're at least by yourself and people are just reading the article, whereas when you're in front of the camera, if you, like, really deep dive into your character, it's like, whoa, I might go to a place I don't want to be around a bunch of people with?
My man, I have been on maybe 50 or 60 sets, my, like, you know, in my second act, blah, 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 as an actor. And I have never, no, I have, what the hell am I doing here? But I have never been on set with, like, Michael Mann or Ron Shelton or Clint Eastwood, like, you know, and been like, what the hell am I doing here? I'm going to be a friggin' sponge, man. I may be, like, a vessel for one of the characters, but, like, you know, or, like, you know, on the low, I'm peeping this, like, you know, this stuff.
Yeah,
you know, it's rare, like, you know, that for me being an actor, man, like, you know, that I'm not happy on set. It's rare. As a matter of fact, when I finally auditioned for and got the role of Sonny Liston, Ving Rhames, you know who Ving Rhames is, right?
Of course,
of course,
yeah.
All right, Ving Rhames was, like, you know, the actor who was chosen. To play Sonny Liston, like, you know, before I stepped into the picture. And when I got the role, you know what he said to me?
What's that?
I met him at the boxing gym when I was, like, when we were training. And he comes up to me, he says, yo, Ben, check us out. Heard you got the role, man. Good for you, brother. Congratulations. He said, do yourself a favor. Every time you can, get a chance and drive 4.5 hours, 5.5 hours up to Sonny Liston's grave and just check in with him. I did that every other weekend, man. And wow. that That was profound, bro. So my man, like, you know, he gave me a gift. Typically, like, you know, acting is very competitive. I mean, like, you know, the world is very competitive, right? Mm-hmm. If, like, you know, you beat out a cat, like, you know, who's that, an established star, typically, like, you know, that star tries to shit on you. But he didn't.
Yeah.
He didn't. Yeah. He gave me love. And, like, you know, that really, like, you know, I think, although, like, you know, I didn't have many lines in Ali, like, you know, I mean, the essence of, like, you know, I mean, listen, I think I got really close to the essence of it.
I mean, it's amazing. You look at some of the stuff you've done. It extends to Broadway. It extends to movies. It extends to working with some of the best directors, some of the best actors out there. But it's funny because a lot of them are boxing roles or your knowledge on boxing or you're coaching someone. So I want to ask you, so now that you're in a totally different world in acting and producing and things like that, do you find yourself having a love of boxing again, but through like a different a prism, a different spectrum? Like, hey, I hated this thing, but it got me to where I am, and now I'm doing things, I'm giving back, I'm almost giving a perspective from boxing to people, and now I love it again.
You know, Scott, you're not a dumb guy.
I disagree, but continue.
Hey, Michael, acting, baby, acting.
Okay, right. Just believe it, right. There we go. No, I got you. It's, I don't think, like, you know, I don't ever think that I'm giving something back because I didn't take anything. You know, I was given a whole lot. You know, I mean, it's like, you know, so like, you know, when you're giving a lot, that means, like, you know, you have to, like, you know, you should also give of yourself a whole lot. Does that make sense?
It does.
Yeah. You know, and in terms of, like, you know, the, man, I just try to pass on to young people or older people, you know, what I've been passed on, like, you know, by certifiable greats, man. You know, when you work with Ron Shelton, when you work with Michael Mann, Matt Smith, Clint Eastwood. I mean, and you're in the midst of, like, Jeffrey Wright. Like, God damn. I mean, like, you know, when I saw Jeffrey Wright on set in Ali, because, like, you know, I've been a Jeffrey Wright head since, like, you know, his movie about Basquiat. This is, like, you know, the 90s, right? And, you know, I remember specifically, I was in the casting. I got to be friends with the casting agent of Ali, right? Her name was Vicky Thomas. And you know, we would talk about actors, blah, blah, blah. And she asked me, like, you know, what do you think will be good for Howard Bingham? Play like Howard Bingham. And by the way, I said, Jeffrey Wright. You know, Jeffrey is, like, you know, a light-skinned black man. Howard was this big, like, you know, tall black man, dark-skinned black man. Jeffrey Wright nails it.
Yeah.
Listen, you know, now do I get, like, you know, points for, like, you know, like, you know, suggesting him? Hell no, of course not. But, like, you know, I mean, but I'm just, like, in that guy's midst, you know, just I'm just lucky, man.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I didn't ask you that. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, I think so. If anything, whatever you said was really interesting. So it doesn't matter if you answered the question.
Scott's okay. Still held up on him. You call on him smart, yeah. So he doesn't care right now. Now, one thing I got to ask you, when you're going on these movies and, like, help actors train them in boxing roles, what is, like, the number one kind of, like, thing that everybody gets wrong going into it when they're doing, like, some kind of boxing role, in your opinion?
Now, that question, man, is one that would that could potentially get me banned. So I'm gonna...
I got you.
I'm busting your chops, man. The number one thing that the most people are incorrect about is about, like, you know, the fury that and then, like, you know, this era of, like, machismo, like, you know, that boxers have. Like, my man, no. It's not about machismo, bro. It's about confidence. There's a difference. Machismo is fake. You know, confidence is something, like, you know, that's derived of, like, years and years of getting up in the morning, 4:30 in the morning, and going to run by yourself in the fucking pitch black and coming back, like, you know, and sparring people. And working the heavy bag and speed bag and watching tapes and perfecting, like, you know, and perfecting your craft, like, you know, that's like, you know, that's discipline.
Yeah.
You know, but, like, yeah, but, like, you know, you see these boxing things, and also, like, you know, when you're doing, like, you know, fight scenes, you know, I'm not shitting on, like, you know, any flick, but, like, you know, there's no way in the world, like, you know, that a fighter is going to get hit 50,000 times in a round, and that round, like, you know, goes on to the next round.
Yeah.
Like, you know, so I try to stress that. And sometimes, like, you know, the director in its in his or her infinite wisdom, you know.
So, Michael, I mean, everything you're saying is ridiculously fascinating, and I don't want to keep you forever. If anything else, I would love to schedule you for another interview down the line, because I could pick your brain for hours.
Let's do it.
But I want to ask you, and
yeah,
I don't know if this is wrong or not, but if you know, like, the amount of skill you had. And the levels you reach in the boxing game, and clearly what you're doing now is what you were meant to do all along. I mean, you're doing a phenomenal thing. But, you know, you think of the levels you went, winning belts, being Evander Holyfield, being with Evander Holyfield, meeting all the top people and it being...
That's education right there, champ. Like, you know, not to cut you off, man.
No.
Me, Evander Holyfield's chief sparring partner, and working with Evander Holyfield as a 19-year-old, an 18-year-old, that's the equivalent of going to fucking Harvard.
That's right? I'm sure.
And, like, you know, and being, like, instructed by, not trained by, because people train horses. This guy, I'm going to mention now, Georgie Benton, he was a master instructor. Not a trainer. People train horses, B. You get me?
Yeah,
he was master.
I mean, my question to you is, if in an alternate universe, your mind was in love with the sport and you loved it with the amount of skill you had, do you think you could have been one of the best ever? And it's not an ego question.
Boxers,
yes.
If I had the size of a Lennox Lewis, a Riddick Bowe. I'll say this, like, you know, hands down. I used to spar with Riddick Bowe when he was, like, you know, 12, 13 years old, and I was, like, maybe, like, 14, 15 years old, right? If I had the size of those cats, I would have had the potential to be that great, but, like, you know, would I had, you know, the desire to, like, you know, subsist in, like, you know, in that world? I don't think I would have.
Yeah.
Like, you know, we all like to be, you know, doubted on, and, like, you know, like, you know, we all like to be praised, but, like, you know, when you're praised as a boxer, it's at the expense of. I never wanted to end up, like, you know, like Muhammad Ali.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to conclude, like, the kind of that statement. You, in the end, I think more importantly than being, you know, a household name boxing, you've made it out of that with clearly your brain intact. You made it out of this, and you're contributing for another God knows 30, 40 years back to people.
Scott, Scott, my acting teacher, if he was listening to this interview right now, he would call you on bullshit. I am not a household name. I am not a household name in boxing.
No, that's what I'm saying. But more importantly, you've made it out of it.
Yeah.
Rather than being a household.
Okay. I'm busting your chops, man. I'm breaking up. I'm a bust.
Oh, that's okay.
I'm busting your chops.
But, I mean, so what's next for Michael Bent? What is he working on? And more importantly, where can people kind of follow you and check you out and see what's going on?
I am in the midst of, I pitched a TV show to some heavy hitting producers in LA maybe 6 months ago. I just got a phone call from my acting partner in LA. There's some heat around this project that we pitched. So, like, you know, there's knock on that. Another thing is, I've got a couple of speaking engagements lined up in the UK where I was born. You know, so, like, I'll go over there and, like, you know, and say some, drop some F-bombs and get like, you know, back to country again. Why are you laughing, Scott? Why are you laughing?
Just busting your balls. Just busting your balls.
So, and lastly, man, like not lastly, but there's potential, like, you know, book, you know, that I'm writing with my the guy I mentioned earlier, Darren Allen. His potential book, like, you know, that
you should definitely do that no matter what.
Yeah. Because, like, you know, you may enjoy talking to me, bro, but, like, you know, if I can make a recommendation, like, you know, if I can make a recommendation, like, this cat, like, Darren Allen, man, like, you know, he's as accomplished as I was as a 160 pound, like, just Google him, Darren Allen, man.
Yeah, we'd love to talk to him.
Is a genius. He's super sensitive. He's intuitive. And he has a lot of knowledge about boxing and life itself.
That's awesome. I like that you think we enjoy talking to you. That's weird.
Are you busting off a chop?
Michael, this
I was going to say balls.
Scott, he's got family in Douglasville. Don't be taunting him.
Yeah.
I don't need this.
Knock on your door. Michael, this has been one of my favorite interviews of the year.
No doubt.
Are you serious?
What?
Are you serious about, like, you know, about, like, you know, in one of your favorite interviews?
Absolutely.
Yeah. 100%. We talk to a lot of interesting people, but it's very clear the honesty coming through your voice, and clearly your experiences are interesting, but you have a really interesting perspective on a lot of things. So I'd love to do this again and talk about a whole other slew of things. So I really want to thank you for your time tonight. Really appreciate it.
Let's do it, brother. All right, thank you, guys.
Wow. All I got to say is, for me, early nomination for a Verbi, that's for sure. One, because he was fascinating, but mostly because he called me smart.
I mean, it's nice that he's a nice person. I mean, he's considered... damaged, if you will, so he doesn't want to hurt your feelings. But yeah, I'll still give him the Verbi after all.
what a fascinating dude, man. Isn't it amazing? You like as I was trying to get through with that last question, like, he, if his heart was there, right, like, if he's that good, he's winning titles where he's not even enjoying what he's doing. Like, imagine he was, like, if his mind was into, I mean, he could have been the greatest ever for all we know.
It's one of those biggest what ifs ever told. I mean, it's so fascinating. I mean, it's not even just getting into the ring and fighting. And it's kind of like with stand up comedy. It's not a question of if you love it by going up on stage. It's a question if you love it if you're writing, if you're doing open mics, if you're networking, stuff like that. When he's not in the ring, he's got a eat right, he's got to train, he's got to spar, he's got to do everything on the planet
right
to do this thing where deep down he's saying, why am I doing this?
Right. It's like, you know, you always hear, like, again, in the comedy world, you see a comedian that, you know, gets all these things and makes it, but you don't realize it's you don't realize it's the work that's gone. Check. Yeah, sorry. My mic was cutting out. So you don't realize it's the work that went into it and behind the scenes and everything that's going on. So it's so easy to cast someone off. It's like, oh, they made it. They got lucky. Like, no. Yeah, you need some luck, but you got to make your own luck sometimes too.
Yeah, it's just an incredible thing when you're putting your life on the line and you literally, it took a life-threatening injury to get him to get out of it, right. But he still had a vehicle with it to find an amazing life and on. It's a hell of a story.
Yeah, really curious, really interested to see what he's, you know, what's next for him. He's got so much potential to do things. Like, I'm sure this is not the last we'll be hearing from Michael Bett. So,
well, obviously not. He's going to come visit me when he sees his family in a couple months, you know. Well, I'll get the 4th of July barbecue going, and we'll sit back with a couple of Budweisers and chat away.
What would you do if you just hear a ring on the door, and you and your wife are just hanging watching TV, and you hear bing bong, and it's just like Michael Bent with like a tub of popcorn and like a six pack?
He's coming in, and I mean, even I didn't know his background. It's like, all right, if you went through this effort to come see me, sure. Yeah.
Plus, I don't think you're going to tell him no. believe it or not, Berlo, I think he's one of another list of guests that can maybe beat you in a fight. So
possibly. I think we're down to about 8 people I could take on this show. So,
oh man, fantastic interview with the one and only Michael Bent. All right, Mike. I don't want to toot my own horn, but you know,
you keep saying that, but then you do it.
You're kind of talking to a big deal here. You know, you're talking to a kind of a big.
Well, I'm talking to myself in the head, so you're probably right in that sense, at least.
I'm a big name. You know, I'm a big name. So much so that I wanted to share with you some of the great gigs I've been doing. Just to really let people know who they're listening to and what kind of level of comic I'm at in the comedy world, you know, and the glory I have from working so hard all these years, you know?
Mm.
So, Mike, the other night, the first gig I had the other night, I played a comedy show in a music shop.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Is it the, it's not the same one as you and I used to love going to, is it?
Which one, Mickey Who?
Yeah, the Mickey Who.
Oh, rock. God, no. but it's funny you say that because going into it, I thought that it would be in a, like a performance space, because that Mickey Who show, other than the really strange Mickey Who himself, the venue was really nice. The
venue set was beautiful. Yeah. Like, it was an actual like amphitheater. Yeah. Like,
very,
I mean,
nice.
That thing could have seated like 200. Just to give our audience kind of a background on it, we basically saw an open mic / show pretty close to us.
Yeah,
in New Jersey. So we went over there on like ran on Friday or Saturday nights, but and like I said, you enter this music store and they're like, oh yeah, the comedy's in the back, and it's literally like a theater. It's like, yes, they must do like plays and stuff like that, and you
bands maybe
in the setup. You're like, man, if you know, if this thing gets hot, man, this is gonna be a kicking place. And it was ran by a guy who called himself Mickey Who.
Yeah.
Who? Yeah.
Mickey Who.
And that was kind of like one of his opening jokes somewhat. He was a very nice guy, but the things that were happening on stage were kind of...
Rubber chickens.
He had rubber chickens. He had a whole thing where he demanded the audience do the Sports Center na-na-na, na-na-na when he came on.
It was the hackiest of hacky stuff. that wasn't even like funny though. Like it wasn't like it was so hacky and quirky that nobody knew what the hell was going on. And he had like he had two guys on the stage with him laughing with himself.
Yeah, it was almost like he needed some Ed McMahon's to his Johnny Carson.
I compare the two. They're close, Mickey Who and Johnny Carson.
I remember there was a trampoline for some reason.
There was a trampoline.
I forget if he called somebody up to jump on the trampoline or he jumped on it.
Really bizarre.
I think it was still correlated with the Sports Center theme song for some reason. And it was just... It was something that was like so awkward. As excited as you were to kind of do this, because it would bring in people, you always had that kind of attitude. Where it's like, I don't know if I want to be associated with this show somewhat. If I recall, you brought some people to that show, and I remember we went back to your place and we were drinking, and they're like, "Man, I mean, I loved your stuff, but man, what was up with?" The host.
Yeah.
It was just...
And to this day, I follow him on Instagram, or he's one of our Instagram. He still posts things that are like, that he like posts sketches that are not like even remotely funny. He'll be like, Mickey Who coming to you. And he'll like look into the camera. It's so weird and awkward. Like he hasn't changed at all. I don't know what his deal is.
I'm guessing he had one moment in 1982 that none of us know about, but in his mind, it's like, yeah, I'm that guy.
Yeah. So anyway, Mike, I was missing that show so much that I took this show at a music shop, and I thought it would be a performance space. Nope, walk in, right in the middle of a music store. Guitars hanging, drum sets on the side. Now... I can't bash it too much because it was set up kind of nicely. Like, it was dark and they had tables with candles on them, but just weird. Another, like, I don't know, 14 people, old, like, one chatty couple. It was funny. I was sitting on the side waiting to go on, and the guy before me is talking, and his voice is coming out of the hole of the acoustic guitars on the wall because it would vibrate the – it was just weird, man. So that was pretty much a dud.
Yeah.
It was fine.
I mean, you always appreciate shows, but at the end of the day, if the room ain't set up for comedy, you're probably better off not doing comedy. If you have like a literal stage where people are going to sit right in front of it, that's going to work. If you're just saying, no, I'll put like a block of wood in the front and the comedians will come up there, it's not going to happen, my friend.
Yeah. So I doubled down on Saturday. So I get this gig from a friend of mine, and he's like, come on out. It's called the 1867 Sanctuary. I'm like, that sounds like a cool, I don't know, maybe a performance space or a bar or something. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah, that sounds like almost like a old school whiskey bar.
Yeah, I thought like maybe it was like an art museum or something that would be cool.
Mm-hmm.
So I get there, sure enough, I arrive, and it is straight up an old church. So immediately I'm like, okay, whatever. But like, we're talking steeple, stained glass, brick building, church. Okay. And it looks like Hogwarts, kind of. And so I go in, and sure enough, it's a church. It's set up like a church. It's pews. It's... The stool is where the priest would be. There's a microphone stand. And it's that quiet that a church has. That indescribable. There's people in the room, but it's just quiet. Like, I think it's like if you grew up in a church or have gone to a church, it's just in your, I don't know. It's just, you know, like you go in there and immediately your voice just goes like this. And you just get low and you're just quiet even if you're talking. And there's no music playing, right? There's no like... So they basically turned this place into a performance art center. They said they wanted to preserve the historic building. But it's not like changed. It's all just pews and everything. And so there's no music playing. So even the comics are talking before the show and you like hear it with like cavernous, you know, a church, cavernous ceilings. So it's just bouncing off the walls. And not to mention there's about 14 people there and they're not sitting all in the front pew. They're spread throughout the entire church. Like, two in the first row, one in the eighth row, three in the ninth row, like, on the right to the left. So, it's like these moments where you're like, why do I do this to myself? Like, you know, you get older and you get a little deeper into it where you have a little bit of respect for yourself and you say, like, you try to take gigs where, like, at least you're getting paid or maybe it's a good opportunity or, and you're like, damn, it's a Saturday night. And, like, I know my wife is hanging with some of our friends. Like, I could be, you start to be like, oh, this is stupid, man.
Yeah, like, and I'll even add to it, there are some church shows that I've done that are pretty good, but they do it in the basement of the church. They do it totally separate from the church, so there's a relaxed feeling and people are having conversations and so forth. Just converting a church into, I guess, a quote-unquote comedy cellar is not going to work, especially when you separate out the audience to the point that it is literally impossible to...
Yeah.
I mean, you would have to be freaking Kinnison or Pryor to kill in that kind of environment.
I mean, and it went as good as it could have gone, I guess I can say. Like, it wasn't like... I didn't bomb, but the most laughs you're getting is like a... and the crowd was old... And it was just weird, and I don't know. Like, it's funny. I, like, opened my set. I was talking about, like, I saw a sign in the wall, and it was like, in memory of the Walters family. Like, can you imagine being that family, like, that church, you know, like, oh, they dedicate to that, and now they're like, yeah, here's Scott telling his like, it's open to jokes now. Like, I don't know.
You see the family wanting to go back to mourn them, and they open it up to some guy talking about sex jokes.
Exactly. That's what I mean. It's like the building, they're like, come on. And that was like, I don't know. I did some priest jokes and talked in priest voice and got the best out of it I could. And that was whatever. And then last night I did Thatcher McGee's in Fairfield, which is like an Irish pub. And I love doing the show because I always get to, almost all the time now, I get to close it out and do basically a half hour, and I've had good shows, and it's only a couple minutes from my house, maybe 15, 20 minutes. And so I go to do the show, I go to close out the show, and the host brings me up. Like I told you guys, I'm kind of a big name here. He brings me up, hey, you guys, he is the host of the Verbal Shenanigans podcast. Welcome, and then he's literally doing that, like, and I just, like, walked up and I grabbed the mic. I'm like, yeah, it's me, Scott Brennan. I'm like, and it turned out to be a blessing in disguise because I literally rolled with this idea for like 10 minutes straight. I just, like, what an intro, guys. You know who you're seeing tonight? And I'm like, no, you don't, because he didn't say my name, you know? And, like, I'm like, yeah, you know, I am such a big deal guy. And the show was on the floor. I'm like, I put it in my rider. I say, look, I don't want no stage. And if you put a light on me, I am not doing it because there's no lights. And it's in front of a fireplace and there's a pheasant. And I'm like, and I request that I perform in front of a pheasant. And then I was like, and I always make sure two full tables are empty, labeled 11 and 12. And there's two tables there that there's no one there. It was just like, and I just use it. I'm like, well, I could be the janitor right now and be like, all right, guys, you got to get out. You got to clean the floor. You guys would not know the difference. But it's just so funny. It's like, and the guy was like apologizing to me. I'm like, dude, don't worry. Like, this is, I forgot people's names before hosting. It's the worst, but it's funny because right before that we were having a conversation, like, at the table. Like, the worst thing about hosting is, like, if you have a lot of comics and you forget someone's name, and sure enough, I drew that card last night. I'm like, the one thing I want is, like, people to know my name. I don't care about the credits at all, but it's like, oh, man, it's just so funny. It's like, you just realize what a big nobody you are all the time in that entry. But, I mean, it turned out to be a raucous crowd. I had a blast with them, like 30 minutes straight. But it was, I don't know. It was just so funny. It was a good like culminating to this like little run of three shows that was. It's just ridiculous.
Well, first off, I mean, nothing says comedy like Monday night comedy.
I said that nothing too. I said I only play Monday nights, people. So you're seeing a big deal. And then there was a gun like on the wall, like right behind the like an old timey gun. I'm like, you guys are gonna be able to see me use this because I'm blowing my brains out after this. And I was like, you will remember me by the headline: local crappy ginger comic blows his head off in Fairfield.
No. Unknown local ginger comic blows his head off. See, if I was in that spot as a host, I would probably be staring at you and try to come up with a name for you. And here is the votes of Verbal Shenanigans. Red McGuffin. Yeah.
Get my head up. I've done that once where I've almost forgot a name, and the guy's name was Ronan Hirschberg, and he was just on the James Corden show. But he was at this mic, the show in the city, which I don't love hosting because there's always a million comics. And I'm like, what's your name? I was like, right. And of course, he was the first comic. So when you host, you're always doing like whatever 10 up front, and then you got to remember that first name. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, what I do when I forgot a name, I just was like, and all right, guys, welcome to the stage. Like, run a high, like a fade away from the mic, like so it sounds like I was saying his name and just kind of clap, like run a high, everybody. But it's. Oh man, I felt bad for the guy. I was like, I came up to him. He's like, oh, I'm so sorry. I'm like, dude, no one's gonna remember me. They're gonna be like, okay, that guy was pretty good or pretty bad or whatever it is. I said, no one's gonna remember. I said, don't worry about it, dude. Like,
I hope he makes it big time, and all he talks about is this idiot who couldn't remember his name at an open mic in New York.
Yeah.
It's like, I know I'm worth billions. I know I've sold out every forum in the world. But to this day, that freaking plaid-wearing Irishman who couldn't remember my name just bites me to this day.
I bet you he didn't even know. I said it so good that I just did the fadeaway clap and got the crowd going in the same thing. But really, it was just a defense mechanism to cover up my stupidity. So, but yeah, that was
well
my
played.
That was my three shows this last week and a half, so it's pretty interesting. But you got Perlo.
This show has taken its place far. Yeah. So I'm wondering how you would have felt going through what I went through
terrible.
A couple weeks ago. Got a new car last year. Finally came up to needing an oil change. So I drive. I call up the dealership, and I'm like, because it's a Saturday, and we're traveling for vacation soon. I'm like, you know, it's Saturday. You'll be up front with me. Like, are you crowded beyond words, or will I be in and get out? And they're like, no. We'll give you an appointment. Come on in. You know, we'll take care of this whatsoever.
Right.
The place is 50 minutes away, but I'm like, all right, might as well. It's a new car. Everything. Every new car, it's like the special oil, the special filter, stuff like that. So I'm like, all right, let me at least be good to my car the first couple of years. So drive down 50 minutes. I left the house at 11:45 a.m. Drove 50 minutes, got there right as my appointment is. The guy, I hand over my keys to the guy, and he's like, yeah, we're a little busy. It's going to be hour 15, hour 30 before you can go out.
Okay.
All right. It not the greatest, but it's livable. I get on Untappd. I see there's two breweries in the area. I'm like, all right, let me check out a new brewery. And both of them were wonderful. And it really killed off the time and everything. Like, I'm walking back and I'm feeling good. I'm just chatting away with the wife and whatever. I get back into the waiting room. As we're chatting along, she's like, so when the hell are you going to leave? You've been gone for about 2.5 hours. And I look at my phone like, oh, it's been a bit. So I'm like, all right, I'm going to go to him. I'm like, hey, what's the update on my car? And I should have figured something out the second the kind of guy He's like, well, let me check on it. And I saw him scurrying around the floor.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
That's always a good start.
Yeah.
So he comes up to me. He's like, we're sorry, Mr. Berlew. What happened was there was another CRV just like yours, and they must have taken that one in instead of yours in line. We're going to put you right in, take care of you, get you right out. All right. You managed your problem. I sit down.
Oh, boy.
Half an hour goes by. Guy comes up to me. He's like, yeah, I'm not going to lie to you. I'm not going to sugarcoat this. We lost your keys.
No.
They lost all my keys. I'm not talking about my car key. I'm talking about
the whole set. My keys.
The whole set.
The key to the house, the key to your handcuffs, all of it.
Every single thing in my life that required a twist and turn to get into the door, gone.
Oh, man.
So I kind of look at him and I'm like, okay. You know, you kind of know me. I try to keep as neutral as possible, even though I might be burning up in my head.
Right.
I'm trying to just stay calm because I say to myself, okay, yelling, screaming's not going to do anything whatsoever. They're like, all right, we're getting a guy to basically get a new key for you, reprogram it, and we're going to take care of you. Half an hour goes by after that. And it's like, all right, we finally reprogrammed your car. Now we're going to take care of your oil change. Meanwhile, I'm texting my wife, Izzy, and she's fuming over this. Like, she is like texting me back, I'm going to call them and I'm going to scream at them and I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. Meanwhile, I'm telling her, what are you going to accomplish by this? And by the way, anything you scream at them, it's going to take out on me because I'm the one in the freaking building right now.
Right.
So I had to spend literally an hour calming down my wife to finally settle it out. So in the long run, it took 5 hours to get my oil change. Lost my keys. They gave me the spare.
They never found them, huh?
Yeah, I'm coming to that part at the end. So they gave me a key, basically told me my other key won't work, my spare one at home, since they had to reprogram it. So I'll have to come back for them to reprogram it will actually work with the car. And then took like after driving home and shopping, I think I pulled into the driveway at 6:15 p.m.
What time did you leave?
11:45 a.m.
Nice. Jesus Christ.
And then on top of it, they kept on saying, we swear we're going to look through the video, you know, trace the steps where what happened. At least we'll know what exactly happened to your keys. We're going to call you on Monday. It's now been 2 weeks.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
With not even a call. And I'll add another thing. So they sent me a text, email, and all. Hey, tell us about your service.
So
I was truthful. I was being very nice to the people, but I spelled out how terrible and stupid they were for this process. The only response, and I literally spelled out, the thing that pissed me off the most is you didn't have the audacity to call me like you said you would on Monday, because literally you literally just told me how much you're saddened by it, but you didn't do the inconvenience of trying to see if you could find it. And then all they did was send a general email back. Oh, we're sorry you didn't have excellent service. We hope to rectify that in the future with you. I'm like,
did they charge you for the oil change or whatever?
No, I mean, the first oil change is free.
Oh.
They basically told me, well, your second maintenance, all the things, the B1 maintenance, they say it costs usually about $160. No questions asked. No charge whatsoever. But it's still like, you took a day from me. You took a day I could never get back.
It's funny because, like, the older I get, the more that stuff just pisses me off. Like, just be brutal. Like, tell me straight up when I get there, hey, we lost your keys, we can't find it. Like, the second you got in there, they should have told you or called you while you were at the brewery. He's like, hey, we can't find your keys. Can you come down? Can you come back for a second? We'll figure this out. And two, it's like just customer service, man. It's just so automated that it could drive you insane. Like, you get on the phone with some of these cable companies or whatever it is, and you're just being passed from one thing to it drives me crazy where the other day I had to call about something, and it was like, okay, tell me your situation, blah, blah, blah. Oh, okay, we'll transfer you to our whatever department. And then you get to that department, it's, okay, tell me what's going on. Like, you have to start from the beginning over and over and over again. And then they just keep sending you back and forth. And then I remember the call just dropped, and it was after like 50 minutes of being tossed back and forth. And it's enough to flip the debt, you know? Like, it's just, everything is so automated that it's getting like, like when you get an actual human, like I'll sometimes call like the bank or whoever and just try hitting zero as many times as I can until you get somebody. Like, and then it's maddening, man. And they don't care. No. Nothing's gonna happen. They're gonna give you a free oil change or something like that, and that's gonna be enough for them. And they don't.
Yeah, they'll charge you $165. It probably was like $20 of pure parts and maintenance.
Oh, exactly.
That it truly costs.
Especially
them.
If you're going to the dealership, they always just crank things up to, like, you do an oil change on your own, it's basically like $30, like if that, $20 between the oil, the four quarts of oil and the filter, it's, you know. But yeah, the convenience is going to Jiffy Lube or whatever it is.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, number one, what you're saying about the zero, yeah. Like, I told my wife thousands of times, I'm like, honey, that's my whole profession. Keep hitting zero.
Yeah.
There's eventually a timeout or a setting that says, all right, send it to the generic post, and then you can talk to somebody. That's number one.
Yeah.
And number two, what drives me nuts, I'm literally sitting back going, like, you're almost forcing me to explode on you the second it happens.
Yeah.
Because if I just had a crap fit, for lack of a better term, and just shouted and made the hugest scene on the planet, I know I probably would have got 100 times more respect and items than how I played it, just being professional, going, okay, you made mistakes, you're going to tell me you're going to work on it, and then in the end, clearly the second I'm out the door, they didn't give a crap.
So. Yeah, they don't care. I mean, I had an experience where it was when I'm selling my house, and I had the house going up on the market the next day, and the sewer pump broke, and this guy was just such, like, I was trying to get the guys out. They told me they were great, and they were coming out, and they never came out. And the guy on the phone was like, yeah, whatever, man. Like, he's like, listen, sir. He's like, you just need to, you know, you don't know what you're talking about. And I, like, lost that on. That's the only time I ever remember losing it on a customer, like, service guy. But I feel like sometimes losing it is, like, you're right. You get more. People get more attention. It's like the whole squeaky wheel gets the grease or whatever the expression is. Sometimes you have to speak up for yourself and, like, throw a fit, and then it's like, okay. But yeah, I wonder where the hell the keys go. Garbage can, maybe?
My thought on this, I was thinking, I even put it on the survey. When they told me they mistook my car with another car, I got a feeling that tech threw my keys in that car.
Yeah.
And it took off with whomever they are. And somebody's just, and I'm sure they were like, hey, can you drive back? And somebody's like, no, screw you. I threw it out in the garbage.
Yeah.
But the worst part of all, Scott, I'm back to no bottle opener on my keychain.
Oh, God. Yeah.
So I'm going to, every time I have a beer, I'm going to have to fly up to Jersey and be like, Scott. Because that was our podcast for about 2 years, where he just like, take this. Yeah. And I remember you gave me like a cheap one and all, like, broke in a week or something like that. Scott, damn it!
Yeah, so, I mean, now, Berlo, that you announced you need a bottle opener, you'll have hundreds at your door after this week. People will be mailing you fan mail and custom openers and things like that, so... don't worry, the Verbal Shenanigans family takes care of you. So,
yeah. Maybe I'll get one from Curry Honda, even though I can't say who serviced my car for legal purposes, but I'll just promote that group. separately.
Yes, yes, yes. All right. Yeah, it's time to get out of here. Well, I'm sorry that happened to you, Burlu. And unfortunately, it's one of those things where something like that will happen again, and it'll drive you crazy the next time, and it's just part of crappy customer service. But
yep, and the day you explode, they'll be the one that's like, sir, we're going to have to call the authorities.
Yeah.
Because you're the bad person in the end.
Yeah. Burlu, anything to actually promote before we go?
I will promote, Scott, rugby's coming down to Atlanta, and the season's starting right around the corner, February rugby. 9th. So if you've always wanted to see a professional rugby game, Major League Rugby, like I said, has come to Atlanta, to Life University. Rugby ATL is starting up their season. They have tickets for low as $20 a seat. That's a hell of a bargain for a professional game and all. You should, if you're interested, check them out. Go to their website. It's rugbyatl.rugby. Not .com. rugbyatl.rugby.
They really want tickets. They really wanted to hammer home that it was rugby.
Yeah, and check out their prices. They have great deals on a reserved family, reserved seating, premium tickets, season tickets. Check out these guys. You might hear from them later on.
Sweet. And I'll promote a friend of ours, a good, very, very, very funny comedian, Mark Riccadonna. Fantastic headliner, awesome, just all-around great guy. He's been on the show before and worked with him a bunch. It looks like he has another new podcast called If Tom Brady. So it's called If Tom Brady ... it's a lot of fun, and it says, love him or hate him, he's the GOAT. That being said, some of his fans still have giant problem. So maybe I haven't even listened to it yet, but I'll support whatever Mark does. It's on Amazon, iTunes, Spotify. If Tom Brady, and I think a lot of it is making fun of their fans and whatnot. And so go check that out, If Tom Brady. Guys, it's time for us to go. And the best thing you can do for us is review us on iTunes and check us out on the various platforms we're on. And the best thing you really could do is share us with your friends and family and say, hey, this episode was good. Check it out. Because that's really what it comes down to. So that's it, guys. Life is funny. Laugh at it. Keep the wind at your back, y'all.
Send me your bottle openers, people.
I squandered my resistance for a pocket full of mumbles, such are promises. All lies and jest, still the man hears what he wants to hear and disregards the rest. When I left my home and my family, I was no more than a boy in the company of strangers, in the quiet of the railway stations, running scared, laying low, seeking out the poor quarters where the ragged people go, looking for the places only they will know. Well, light a light.